Welcome to Hot Plate, the conversations you should be having about your food and drink. I'm your host, Mirella Amato. Today on the Hot Plate, what happens when a chef can't smell what they're cooking? And is it ever too early for a drink? We're also going to dive into Curious Kitchen, where we taste strange things and sink our teeth into some squigglies. But first, some introductions. I'm Mirella Amato, and I'm a sensory consultant. My work is focused on breaking down flavors and aromas in beer and explaining them to people. I'm an international beer judge and a master cicerone, which is the beer equivalent to a master sommelier. And I've written an award-winning book called Beerology for people who want to find out a little bit more about beer and learn to appreciate it.
I'm Joshna Maharaj. I'm a chef, activist, and speaker. I do work in community food security, really figuring out what grassroots connections are for communities and the barriers that exist. For the last 7 years, I've been working to rebuild food systems in public institutions around Toronto, really finding new roles and new spaces for chefs to support communities and make healthier, more nourishing connections.
So I'm here today with Joshna Maharaj.
Hello.
And Joshna, would you describe yourself as a chef or an activist?
I take both.
Okay.
And the thing that I have chased actually is the chef slash activist title.
Okay.
Right? Really to carve out that bit of space. So right now, chef, activist, and author is the way I'm talking about myself. On the way, author, to be honest.
When's the book coming out, do you think?
The book is coming out this time next year. I have 19 days till I have to submit my manuscript to my editor.
And that's just the beginning.
That's it.
So what is the focus of your activism then?
So my activism is many-fold, let's say, but okay. The root is about equitable access to good food for everybody, understanding that access to really quality food is a basic human right, mm-hmm. and that there are a lot of really sort of idiotic things standing in the way of everybody in this country, in this city, on this planet, eating really good food.
Good food.
Yes. Proper food that nourishes a body properly, right? It's just the state of affairs of our food system is sort of really in an almost critical crisis. And so it's I have decided to use whatever position I have as a chef to scream and yell for a more equitable, just, sustainable food system.
Nice. And you have won awards for this, correct?
There's a couple, yes. It's nice. Sweet recognition for the fact that I'm trying to do this thing that there's not so much, not so many footsteps to follow, let's say, in this work. And so it's super nice when people appreciate it.
And what was your training?
Training as a chef.
Formal.
Yeah, formal chef training. French tradition, all of that sort of sometimes nonsense. And then I sort of went off and did my own thing. Never going down the restaurant road, community food centers and community food security has really been my love and where I have grown myself as a chef.
It's interesting how as you go through your career, you slowly find your place.
Totally.
Right? When was it that this clicked for you?
This clicked probably when I was like 31, 32. Mm-hmm. So it's just over 10 years ago. When I was like, oh, no, this is the thing that I'm going to do. I went to...
And how long had you been chefing by then?
About 3 years.
Is that a verb?
Yeah, I'll take it.
All right.
I went to Terra Madre.
Okay.
Which is Slow Foods' biannual global conference. Mm-hmm. And heard the state of affairs of the food. And I was like, came home and I was like, oh, clearly this is my work.
Yeah.
For my life. Got it.
Nice.
Done. Thank you, Carlo.
So that would have been about 10 years ago.
Yeah, 2010. That was the last time I was there. So we're not far. Yeah.
Wow. So that's just about when I started my journey in beer, 2007. And so I went into sort of the more sommelier route as a master cicerone and then an international beer judge. But my focus was always on flavors and aromas explaining them to the public, which is what led to my book. And now I'm just really just getting super geeky on the sensory side and
it's kind of awesome,
how to break down those flavors and explain them and really help breweries make quality and consistent products. So that's my passion. Which I've also discovered, through the journey.
Mm-hmm.
So Josh and I, you were going to bring a very interesting topic today.
I know.
About
it's
the sense
a
of
big
smell.
Confessional, right?
Tell me.
So I have recently had sinus surgery that also involved a bit of a surprise septoplasty. once they went in there and discovered my septum taking a right-hand turn. But I had been suffering with congestion for the last 6 or 7 years. And for the last like 4 years, I have not been able to smell.
At all?
Not a thing. Right?
How does that work as a chef?
Well, there it is. Right? My instinctual response to this was to keep it a secret.
Of course.
Because I was like, nobody trusts a chef who can't smell.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I have to start doing things like relying heavily on timers, even just for like a toast and for, you know, those kinds of things.
Could you not tell if it was burning?
I could not. Nothing.
Whoa.
Nothing. The depth of this hit me. Mm-hmm. When I had nasty notes from my apartment management about the fact that my organics bin was not being taken out frequently enough.
Oh dear!
Right, and
that. Wow.
And when I went to open the thing, and like I wasn't really remembering what was in there, and when I put my face in what I otherwise knew, if I could smell, I would have been assaulted with this horrible odor. But I felt it. I felt the burn of it, but I couldn't smell a thing.
Wow, that's intense.
Right?
That's called anosmia.
Exactly.
I think.
Yeah, I think
and
that's it.
And I'm familiar with it because about 10 years ago, I was running a beer judge training program.
Okay.
To train a bunch of people to learn how to be beer judges.
Right on.
And one of the candidates approached me and she said, I'm anosmic.
Right.
Is this going to be an issue?
Right.
And
what was your answer?
Fascinating. Well, because when it comes to sensory evaluation, I often encounter people who aren't drinking. They aren't tasting because, you know, they're pregnant or there's a driving issue.
Okay.
And I always say, that's no problem because you do 90% of it with your nose.
Mm.
You can get most of it by the sense of smell. The taste is just a small confirmation.
Right.
But in this case, I just thought it was an interesting challenge. And I said to her, look, why don't you participate to the best of your ability and take the test and we'll see what happens. I mean, I'm in no position to say you can't do it.
Yep.
And I'm certainly in no position to evaluate whether it is possible or not, because, you know, the body is amazing. You found some interesting tricks with timers and so on. But, you know, the body is adaptable. If you read scientific papers about people who've lost
100%.
Certain senses and they heighten others. So she had been anosmic from birth.
Right.
And I assumed that she would be okay. And guess what? She passed the test.
Yeah. I actually have the experience of the rest of my senses really kicking in.
Really?
Right. Because I have zero report of overseasoned food.
Right.
Right. Nobody is like, whoa, that was way too much. Right. My mm-hmm. my intuition as a cook and my otherwise notion of what this is all of, you know, of how to put a good flavor together all kicked in.
Interesting.
And I've been thankfully delighted. Right. Because mm-hmm. that could have been mm-hmm. an easy shot to the bottom there for me.
Did you ever feel like you were cheating people or being dishonest in hiding this critical piece?
Yes.
I mean, that's a.
Yes.
A big
frequently.
Part of food and cooking
frequently.
Is the sense
frequently.
Of smell.
And it was like, it was crushing inside because I love this work. This is my life's work, clearly.
Yeah.
And to be able to not participate.
Yeah.
In this way, yet still have an image, professionalism, ethics, whatever it is to maintain outwardly, just because I was like, this is not the final answer.
Right.
Right. I'm not, this is a temporary scenario with what's happening. And so I don't need to come out of the closet about this.
And now you're fixed.
Wow, here it is. But yeah, there definitely felt like I was lying.
And this is a permanent fix?
This so fast, for what we say, there's a new life here.
Amazing.
Right? Two big, smooth, easy breaths that I'm taking.
Yes.
All the traffic issues have been sorted out.
Well, I think it's great you're talking about it.
Thanks.
Maybe a little piece of activism to add
a little
to your...
A little bit. But really, it's only because I know that I'm better that
right.
I'm happy to talk about it. If it was still, if there was still a question mark, I think I would be still silent.
I understand. So that must have been a really isolating experience for you, holding this secret
in. You know, it really was. It feels dramatic to say that, but it really
was. I
don't
think it's dramatic.
It really was. It felt like I had this mega dirty secret
mm-hmm.
and that I desperately could not be found out, right? And when
yeah.
I was thinking about this conversation, I did a little bit of research just to see if somebody else, another chef, has gone through this, right? Because famously, there's a story of Grant Achatz from Alinea in Chicago, where
okay.
she got tongue cancer, mouth cancer.
Oh, my goodness.
And he couldn't taste for the longest time. Thankfully, it has returned, and he has restored himself to mega levels of excellence.
Okay.
But for a while, he was a chef who couldn't taste.
That's also
right?
tricky.
And I am sure we will see a dip in patronage, right, at the Red, all of that is like on pause because you can't taste. And then I found
a dip or the opposite.
I mean, who knows,
I would rush
right?
in out of curiosity, you know, but I guess that's, yeah. You know.
And then I found this piece of this young chef who had lost his smell for 10 years.
Oh.
And kept it a secret and worked to keep it a secret for all of that time because he knew that it would not fly and that he would be mistrusted and that right. we could potentially not get hired as a result.
Right.
Right. And I was so grateful for another story of somebody who instinctively felt really desperate to keep this secret.
Did you reach out to him for tips?
I didn't yet. That's a good idea. That's a really good idea. Be like, how did you pull it off? And it seems like his stakes were a little bit higher because he was working on a line in a restaurant all the time.
Wow.
Which is not my thing, right? If I'm cooking, it's more for a one-off thing for an event where I have other people around, so I have some buffers.
Right. But I would think a line would be more of a challenge because, less of a challenge because you have to do the same thing every day. So it's very methodical. Wouldn't it be easier to sort of hide in that way than for someone like you who just has to create something new every time?
What we learned from this piece was that it all came to blows for him because in the regular run of maintaining the fridge and getting prep done and everything, there was some beef. And there was suspicion that the beef had turned.
I know where this is
right?
going.
And the only way to really see is to stick your face in. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To get the ammonia intensity of that, you know, turned flesh.
My partner makes fun of me because I smell all my food.
Right.
Every food. I always smell it. And
that's
I don't even
know.
Notice I do it. But
right.
it's just a quick way. It's a quick way to check. So he couldn't do that.
He couldn't do it. And he was like the only one around.
Oh,
right?
dear.
No dishwasher. No anybody to be like. To bounce this off of.
So now we're talking serious food poisoning.
Well, the stakes are high,
yeah.
right? Exactly. And so he actually had to confess. He realized how high the stakes were, and that's when it all came tumbling down.
Did he lose his job?
He didn't.
Okay.
He didn't, right? And I think it's opened up a really interesting discussion about the question about whether or not, because I started thinking about other senses.
Right.
Right? And I, like, honestly, I think part of the reason this works this way is because I can hide it.
Yes.
I can't hide being blind.
Right.
Right? Other things are not as easy to conceal, but it is relatively easy to conceal the fact that you cannot smell.
We don't talk about it a lot. It's one of the senses that we've explored the least.
Right. Right. And so you can pass.
Yeah.
Right? And nobody really has any questions. But I am curious. I'm curious to know what you think, what other people think about whether or not we were just getting too dramatic unnecessarily, or whether this really a notion that if you have a chef who cannot smell, you should not trust them.
Interesting, but now you have a superpower, right? Because you've regained your sense of smell, but your other senses are still heightened.
What I'm not sure of is, do they still stay at attention like that, or do they know that their fifth pal is back?
I don't know. I feel like you've developed these skills. Well, only time will tell.
We're about to find out. But it is only now that I know that my smell is coming back mm-hmm. that I am coming out and confessing.
But could you still sense some things in terms of the smell or like nothing at all?
Not a
that
thing.
Is
I would
fascinating.
Go to wineries and I would, you know, all of this, and they would bring out this bottle and, you know, and when the chef's around and everybody does this, and they literally, people will put things in front of me and I will lie.
Oh my goodness.
Right? And they're huge. Like, you should be able to smell a big, hearty red wine.
Yes.
That's a thing to
yeah.
smell. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Like a giant, gutsy Tuscan red kind of
oh,
thing. You know, I was
yeah.
in an Italian family's house, and it's like that the
jammy
buttery
notes
gloriousness,
buttery.
Right?
Oh.
You could, that on the nose hits you so beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
Then somebody else was like, oh, I think this is turned, and I think this is really vinegary now under my nose. Vinegary is something you should easily be able to smell.
Right.
Nothing.
But you could taste it.
I could taste it.
The acidity,
yep.
I would guess.
Yep. And I could feel the tingle of it.
Wait, so how did you test recipes?
It's a really good question.
Did you rely on other people's palates?
Yes. I always had somebody else who would test for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I put it together the way I thought it would work.
Yeah.
And then I would test it a couple of times and give it to other people.
That's fast. So your experience really mixing things helped, you know.
Yes.
Took you most of the way there. And then you just needed someone to confirm the fine-tuning.
Totally. Totally. And I remember
when I really
understood what was happening was when I was making a pot of curry. Right? Because it's like first oil, then chilies and cumin seeds get spluttered in that oil. then onions and garlic and ginger and masala. Like, it's an intense amount of fragrance.
Yeah.
And when I'm usually doing it, you are happy to sort of bathe in the steamy intensity of all of that. Mm-hmm. And I watch myself face right in the pot. Nothing.
Oh, what a panic.
Right? I couldn't smell. I could feel it.
That happened to me once.
Yeah. Smell any of it.
Do you know what area was where the blockage was?
Exactly. My entire sinuses, like all around both eyes.
Because here's the interesting thing. I have had that experience that you're talking about. Because, you know, you get a cold.
Sure.
And you get stuffy.
Of course.
And a Russian Imperial Stout, you know, those bold beers with the roasted notes and the strong alcohol and the cherry and coffee. Just so delightful. And I could smell nothing. Meanwhile, this is again, and I'm feeling you 100% on this shame piece. Man. Because last year I was judging at the Great American Beer Festival, and on the second day I got a cold, and I thought, oh no, oh no, what am I going to do? And I decided, you know what, I will sit in the morning panel, and if I find that I can't smell anything, I'm just going to recuse myself. Because, you know, unlike you in this situation, I am judging which beers are going to win medals. It's not fair. You know, I'm not going to blunder through that.
It's the truth.
And shockingly, through this cold, my nose was running down my face. I could smell everything.
Really?
I was completely in tune with everyone at the table. I made it through the whole day. I judged the whole next day.
Right.
And I was blowing my nose every 3 minutes.
Wow.
And people were, you know, surprised that I was blowing my nose so often. But I, you know, I didn't tell anyone I was sick because it wasn't affecting what I was doing.
Right.
But I mean, our sense of smell in general, I think, is not very understood. There's a, I'm reading a book right now, which you should read.
Okay.
It's called What the Nose Knows.
Oh, that's
it's fantastic.
Like exactly the book I need to be reading right now.
And it's about all the things that we assume about smell that are just not true. Because the sense of smell is so tricky. So, for example, smoking. This is the first thing that came to mind when you talked about your topic. A lot of people think that heavy smokers can't taste or smell as well as people who don't smoke. That has not been proven.
Right.
All the studies are completely inconclusive, which makes sense to me because one of the best beer judges I know is a chain smoker.
Right.
And definitely if you have a cigarette within 10, 15 minutes, your taste is impacted. But beyond that, like, we have no proof.
Right.
Another thing I thought was fascinating.
Huh.
This is a bit of a tangent.
Yeah.
But we all think that dogs can smell way better than we can.
Yeah.
Apparently that too is not true.
You're kidding me.
They can smell some things that we can't smell, like diseases and things like that.
Helpful.
But their ability to sort of hone in on smell and follow a trail, we have that ability too. We just don't train people to do it. So they've done studies where they've, you know, trained people on one smell.
More socially acceptable at the airport to have dogs than people sniffing at your bags.
But if you take the time to train a person,
they could do it.
They could do it.
Oh my God. There's an argument for a jobs program in there somewhere. I love that.
But in your case, it was just gone and
it
now
was
it's
just
back.
Gone.
It's time for Curious Kitchen.
Okay.
And I've brought something for us to try.
I'm really excited.
Let me ask you this, Josh. Now, how do you feel about eating bugs?
I don't recoil, but I won't choose it.
Okay. Do you have any preferences in terms of types of bugs?
I have not forayed.
You haven't delved in that far.
Not far enough to prefer one over the other.
All right. Well, my preference is mealworms.
Okay.
And I found these tasty snacks at Loblaws, but brace yourself.
Let's just talk about the fact that they're at Loblaws.
I know.
Right? That's hella mainstream.
Except,
let's say.
I got them on massive sale at Loblaws because no one bought them.
Dun, dun, dun.
But brace yourself. They're not just mealworms. I have barbecue. And I have cheddar cheese.
Cheddar cheese mealworms.
Which one do you want to try first?
I want to try the cheddar cheese because the barbecue is going to be bossier.
It might.
Well, at least, exactly.
Then we could hope.
You're like, uh-huh.
I'd love that they made them into flavored
that
snacks.
That is amazing.
It's so ambitious.
Right? With a beer.
Yeah.
Right? That's the suggestion is that you can just...
Is that what it says?
No, it doesn't.
Probably
great
with beer.
I just like that larva is the first ingredient.
I actually did a full pairing, a full dinner of crickets
bugs.
And beer. Yeah, and the crickets Fantastic. Were prepared in various ways for the various courses. We did it for Halloween 1 year.
What
And
fun.
It was sold out.
Okay, so cheddar cheese.
Yeah, let's go for it.
Oh, my God. What a thing. Bugs. Now, are these bugs or are these like worms?
They're mealworms.
They're worms.
Yeah. Okay. I think they're mealworms. It's the most common worm that's used to cook.
Original worm snacks. S-N-A-X.
They're just doing everything they can to make the bugs
better,
cool.
Right? Snacks. S-N-A-X.
I'm all for it. I mean, it's a sustainable source of protein.
That's
and
the thing.
People get squeaked out or squeaked out.
I know, but I don't know that you need to be.
With mealworms, I find them to be a tasty snack. It's okay. The cheese that's throwing me off a little bit.
Oh, it's like a cheesy.
Yeah.
It's like a skinny little cheesy.
With
Apologies
protein.
To anybody who can't not stand the sound of this crunching.
It's not as offensive as I thought it would be.
Not at all. Oh, there's the cheddar cheese really is there, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's milk powder happening in there, so it's a real thing.
What I like about the mealworms is they have a very delicate flavor. It's just almost a little bit nutty.
It is. And you know, I like the way it just completely dissolves.
Yeah.
So I would imagine it like the garnish on a canapé.
Ooh, yes.
Right on top of something, on top of a deviled egg.
Mm-hmm.
Right? As a little crunchy je ne sais quoi.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Certainly stirs up some conversation.
Now,
right?
I mean, in all honesty, this is 1.9 grams.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not entirely sure. Like, I need fistfuls of these things.
Right.
Right?
Yes. Yeah, but baby steps.
But
I think they weren't able to sell this size container.
Precisely.
You want to try the barbecue?
Though. Yeah, I totally want to try the barbecue. What a thing.
Yeah.
I think I'm more compelled by the dried up worm. Like, it's actually quite
They're
enjoyable
delicious.
In your mouth.
They're very good.
And you look like, because, and this, like, I don't know if this is distinctive, this is specific to a mealworm, but it has these, like, little sections.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And the way they feel in your mouth is actually quite pleasant.
I'm a fan.
Pleasant. Okay,
a lot
barbecue.
Of people eat crickets.
Yeah.
I don't know how I got turned on to the mealworms.
You know what I prefer for the mealworm over the cricket?
What?
Is the cricket has tons of little bits that get all stuck up in your teeth.
In your teeth, right? Those
the cricket,
legs.
What the extended release sort of scenario that happens there with the cricket? Like the legs and the crunchy bits?
Yeah.
It all gets all stuck up in the teeth, whereas this is a little more sophisticated.
They also have, to steal a Joshna term, a more bossy flavor.
Thanks.
The crickets. Whereas the mealworms have a very delicate,
they do.
Delicate, nutty. I would say it's coming through the barbecue, which is not as
well. It's
pungent
actually quite nice that the first taste is the worm, and the second taste is whatever sort of funny powder they decided to put on it.
Yeah, I feel like the barbecue was a fail.
The barbecue was a bit of a nothing. Yeah,
yeah.
But I can see dill pickle, salt and vinegar, sour cream and onion. Like, oh, clearly,
we can start our own line.
The taste of the worm is a little bit nutty and toasted.
Yes.
I can say. And the texture is very cheesy-like.
Yeah.
In that, you know, the cheesy, it just dissolves on your tongue.
The crunch, yeah.
Right? Same vibe. With
Not
you
cheese,
see that it's
cheesies.
The cheesy, actual little
the
funny
cheese
snack.
Yeah.
Because any moisture
completely
dissolves this thing in a way that's quite pleasant.
Also, this is screaming for a beer.
Oh my God, that's really the truth.
Want a nice 100% golden lager or something with a slight toasty
bugs.
Note.
Oh,
A nice amber
Just feeding
lager.
Each other, right? This, maybe with a little bit more saltiness, right? To have you chase into your glass a little more frequently.
Mm-hmm.
I could spend some time at a bar with these.
Absolutely.
Nice one.
Ha ha.
Nice one. I love that. Mealworms.
What I wanted to talk about today is this new bill that's being examined, allowing us in Toronto to start consuming alcoholic beverages in restaurants as of 9 a.m.
What a thing!
On weekends, on Saturdays and Sundays.
Right.
Which would be moving it up from the 11 a.m.
Right.
Which
right.
it is now Monday to Sunday. And I just found out that Ontario has the latest time. So in Nunavut, I think at 10 a.m. is the when they can start drinking. And in other areas, it's 8 a.m. or even all the way at 6 a.m.
Someone's got a 6 a.m.
Yeah, and that makes sense to me because some people work the night shift.
Yep.
And if at the end of a night shift, if you want to, you know, have a meal and, you know, a nice pint of beer,
sure.
decompress before, you know, you can't go right back, right to sleep after you've worked
you
all
can't.
Night.
No, it's the truth.
But here we're just inching towards
so what was the,
a 9 a.m.
What was the impetus? What spurred this on? Do you know?
Yes, the impetus was actually the fact that, well, now we have sales in grocery stores.
Right.
And in grocery stores,
yes.
they could only sell at 11.
I had this crazy experience
right.
of seeing the stuff on the shelves, but not being able to pick it up and purchase it.
So
yes.
I think that was making a lot of people very
yes.
cranky.
Yes.
And
yes.
so to address that, they moved the
Got
sale
it.
In grocery stores to 9 a.m. in December. And so now the reasoning is, well, if you can just go buy it at 9 a.m. in the grocery store, why can't they
well
just,
be able to just
consume
it?
That's how
right.
they managed
yeah.
this, what seems like it's a dramatic, huge step and shouldn't be. I don't know why. I don't understand what the concerns are. People were talking about, I mean, what do you think the concerns are?
I don't see the concern as anything else than a remnant of our weird prohibition.
Absolutely.
Right, our weird attitudes. I have frequently been at brunch and ordered coffee and then said, as soon as it's 11, please bring the Caesars.
Right.
Like,
of course.
You wait. You're like, I'll have the latte and the pastry now, but then in 45 minutes, we're going to have Caesars or mimosas or whatever it
is. And that's just
right?
an inconvenience.
And everybody giggles and we know how we're going to play this game. But I'm like, what's the problem?
Right? Seriously.
This crazy history of prohibition that we have that assumes that, I don't know, if you give people freedom, they'll just lose their minds.
Well, the truth of the matter is,
in the streets
yeah.
in the morning when other, I guess, people are going to church or all the lovely things that people will do on a weekend.
Right. So the concerns that have been cited are noise.
Right.
Which is
all those drunk
hilarious to
drunks,
me.
All those morning drunks.
Like, I don't think a 9 a.m. mimosa is going to lead to rowdy behavior.
No.
But
especially
we'll
if
see.
You imagine a hair of the dog scenario. It's just about restoring sanity, right? You're not going to go ripping through the streets. You're just going to be able to sort of open your eyes and take a breath.
I feel like one coffee and one mimosa
right.
Equals less noise than four coffees.
Right? Nice. Nice argument.
That's what I'm going to say
there.
I
like it a lot.
There were some concerns about, there was one person who raised concerns about gun violence, which I don't even understand.
Oh my God. In Ontario?
Yeah. It wasn't fleshed out in the article. I wish they had elaborated on that because I was thinking, just imagining the brunch, I don't
yes.
know. I don't know what that is.
Implausible
and then
correlations.
Drunk driving, which again, it doesn't matter what
24
time
hours a
of
day is a potentially dangerous
drinking.
Moment for drunk driving, right?
Yeah, I don't understand how the shift in time is going to... And I don't understand why it's only weekends. Why can't we just
yeah,
be 9 a.m.? It is interesting, though, because all this hysteria is based on, you know, very real things. You know, when people talk about... When we talk about prohibition now,
right.
we make fun of it and, you know, it was, you know...
Right, a day's
a
gone by.
A failed experiment.
Thing. Totally,
and,
totally.
You know, all we think of is how tragic it was that no one could drink. But we
right.
don't think back to the time before that when there were very real issues around alcohol consumption not being regulated, alcohol being cheap
right.
And everywhere. You know, in the UK, they talk about the gin craze
yep.
and,
yep.
you know, people just who had been used to drinking beer. Suddenly having access to gin, the gin is cheaper. Now they're drinking
and
gin
intense,
all
right.
day, every day, the way they were drinking beer. And
oh,
there's
God.
All kinds of issues happening. There was, you know, spousal abuse.
Like
I won't even get
really
into
sloppy.
Syphilis, people's oh, noses
of
falling off. Just
the,
in just, oh my goodness, I'm reading a horrible book
so really
about
like,
prohibition.
It's like the pendulum swung too far in one direction, right?
It
and
did.
Maybe the point is that left to our devices, we are not doing such an awesome job of managing ourselves.
At the time,
right?
When it was new,
yeah.
right? That was like the teenage years of alcohol. I always like to look
right.
at things, you know, any movement
arc.
As a broader
right.
picture
yeah.
as there being teenage years. Like right now, we're in the teenage years of craft beer. People are just discovering
okay.
it.
Nice.
They're going
stretching
crazy,
their legs.
You know,
right. Right.
and everything's
okay.
getting wild and insane. And eventually it'll just normalize. I find any, you know, larger movement happens that way.
Well, I like that.
And, you know, when if you think back, people used to drink beer instead of water because they
yeah.
thought, well, they knew water carried disease.
Right.
And
there
so
there was trust and safety in the
curious.
Yeah, so, you know, you're drinking beer all day every day. All of a sudden, gin is cheaper or booze is cheaper. You just start drinking that all day every day.
It's
and
the truth.
Then industrialization happened, and now you're working heavy machinery, and you're like...
That's really what changed the game, right?
Accidentally, you know,
chopping
your arm off or, you know, like there were all kinds of issues that were happening back then as a direct result of people not really being able to regulate their alcohol. But instead of addressing that and, you know, through moderate legislation like they did in the in Europe, here they said, nope, certainly in the
Shut
U.S.,
Yeah.
No more drinking for anyone. Right. Zero. Yeah. In Canada, we were a little bit less crazy about it. Some provinces did have prohibition for almost 50 years, and some basically
isn't
didn't.
Isn't there some amazing story about the fact that the Junction had prohibition like into the late 70s or something like that?
More recently than that.
Like the 90s or something?
Yes. Yeah.
Right? I think there was a section of the Junction that was dry.
Yeah.
The Junction, the northwest end of Toronto.
Yes.
Right.
So,
there's this, that little community there, right? There's lots of train traffic through there. I know that.
Which is now full of bars.
But ironically, that little neighborhood on that stretch is full of. But like well into the 90s, that was a dry community.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The way that prohibition happened in Canada is that each area and then eventually each province could vote whether to go dry or not.
Oh my God, that's so interesting.
And, you know, and then they voted to repeal. And they had that one little area for the longest time remained dry.
Thanks.
And they overturned it. And now it's a really lively area. There's at least two breweries there and some wonderful bars and restaurants.
I wonder how much noise disturbance.
And not surprisingly. Oh, yeah.
Right. Happens in that neighborhood at 9 a.m. in the morning.
And not surprisingly, when it was dry, it was dead.
Right. Go figure.
Right.
That's amazing. Our relationship with booze is a curious one, right? Like our human relationship with booze is very curious.
It's kind of weird.
To that point, the rest of the world seems to be on top of this already.
Yep.
Right? Because I remember being in Rome chasing what everyone said was the best espresso.
Yes.
Right? This Cafe Sant'Eustachio had this, and they have this like piece of metal so you can't see how they pull the shots.
Right.
Secrets.
Ooh.
Right? So everyone on the way to work, it was 8 o'clock in the morning. Everyone's all dressed up the way Romans are on their way to work, and they saddle up, take down that espresso in three sips, and off they go, right? But then my pals and I noticed that there were shot glasses also being cleared away quickly in the sort of the conveyor of things.
Right.
And we sort of did some investigations and discovered that it was espresso shots and Zambuca.
Oh.
No, not Zambuca.
Grappa?
What is Grappa, thank you. Grappa, and that there was a way to do it. Right? So we did the intel and we figured out that you take a sip of the espresso so it coats your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Then not even thinking, you shoot the grappa and in the vacuum
of that. So you don't have
to
taste it.
Precisely. In the vacuum of that, you take down the rest of the espresso. So it's like a little grappa sandwich with espresso bread, if you will.
Amazing.
Right? And honestly, my friends and I did it. And the best way I can describe the experience was like when you're playing a video game. And you roll over the magic mushroom and you get that like
Ring.
Augmented boom, 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 boom,
yeah.
Right? And I looked around and realized that everybody around me was playing this same game. And I was like, oh, this is the fuel that is getting everybody to work this morning.
Yeah. And no one's, you know, lining them up.
Right.
And
no
do it, right?
There's
nobody
disorderliness
and off you
in
go.
The street. Everyone's walking to work.
But was there gun violence? I have this vivid memory of I was... A student activist.
There it is.
I have some activism in my
youth. I
feel it. You're not the only activist in the room. And, you know, we had gotten up very early and we had been out picketing and we sauntered into a bar and it was, you know, 9 a.m. Or 8 a.m., I think, actually. And there were just a bunch of people there drinking beer.
Right.
They're a large format.
Yeah.
Le
Bat
50.
Right. Le Bat 50.
And it was just really civilized. And, you know, I was so surprised to see this because, of course, you know, we had the 11 a.m. Cutoff in Ontario. And, they, you know, they I talked to the gentleman, and they, sure enough, had been working nights, and this was their way to unwind. And it just really opened my eyes to the fact that a lot of our regulations are really based on this assumption that everyone's schedule is the same.
So much of my work, I see this. It's just like nonsensical things just get thrown up, hoping that something will stick.
Yeah.
When you're like, you just are really not excited about things changing.
Follow Hot Plate on Instagram and Twitter at Hot Plate Pod. You can follow me at Beerology on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And follow Joshna at Joshna Maharaj on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Thank you to Joshna for joining us today. Our audio engineer is Brad Tigwell. Hot Plate is produced by Mirella Amato, that's me, and Dennis Coyne. I'm thirsty.